Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one fat-ass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. It's honestly provocative talk radio. Thanks for joining me on the Radio Northwest Network that serves the states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. And you're welcome to join the conversation at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@larslarson.com. I thought I'd start with a very easy question, and you would think there is a common sense answer to this question, and yet, would you expect that the Pacific Northwest governments, Oregon and Washington especially, would actually use that kind of common sense? And here's the question. Should cities hire illegal aliens as cops to enforce the law, and most of the law is enforced on citizens of the United States? I mean, occasionally law enforcement gets involved in illegal aliens, but as you know, both Oregon and Washington are sanctuary states where illegal aliens actually have superior rights to those of American citizens. So now, as Law Enforcement Today is reporting it, following the lead of its progressive neighbor to the south, California, Washington State is poised to pass a bill that will make it lawful for non-citizens and illegal aliens who are recipients of DACA to work as police officers and press charges as deputy prosecutors. Now, in other words, they say some individuals who are themselves criminals by way of entering this country illegally will be able to actually deprive actual citizens of their rights. As Law Enforcement Today puts it, make it make sense. Now, does any part of that make sense to you? You've got a country that has, unfortunately, under a previous president, the worst president of the 20th and 21st century, Joe Biden, who's now thankfully gone off to the beach in Delaware. But he allowed more than 10 million illegals to come into the country. And his predecessor, not Donald Trump, but his predecessor in Barack Obama, when Joe Biden was vice president, Barack Obama literally did something called DACA, the Deferred Action on Childhood Arrivals. And 1 year before he did it, he was asked, why don't you just sign a piece of paper and say all these people can stay? And Obama very carefully, as you understand, Barack Obama is a constitutional scholar, or so he claims. He said, I can't do that. I don't have the legal authority to do it. And then about 1 year later, Barack Hussein Obama did exactly what he had declared illegal to do a year before. And then the courts weighed in and they said DACA was not adopted legally. It is illegal, but they wouldn't throw it out. So you've got about 600,000 illegals that are covered by that. And now there are states like Washington State. California has already done it. Washington State says maybe we should make them cops. Now imagine the rich irony that somebody who is a citizen and lives in, say, Oregon or Washington or California, you are pulled over by the police, and a person who is himself a criminal, he is illegally in the country, he is currently breaking the laws of the United States, he's the one who's going to put you on the ground, put handcuffs on you, and haul you off to jail and deprive you of your liberty, which is a constitutionally protected, God-given right. He's going to haul you off to jail, and then you're going to be put in front of a judge and a prosecutor who may also be an illegal alien if Washington State passes this law. As I said, California already has. The prosecutor is going to say to the judge, we need to convict this man of a crime. Now, they haven't yet got to the point where DACA are going to become judges, but maybe that's just the next step down the road. But ask yourself that question. Should cities hire illegal aliens as cops and prosecutors to enforce the law in the United States of America? Glad to be with you on a Monday. Always glad to take your calls. If you want to jump into what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it happens right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. And if you're a naysayer, we're going to put you right to the head of the list. We always have. We always will. I just ask you this. If you're going to be a naysayer, come to the program with your facts in a row, with your argument in a row. Make your best case and then stick around for a few questions from me. Our X poll question today, should states end vote by mail? I would answer yes to that. There is currently a bill before the Oregon legislature put forward by Senator David Brock Smith. And he says, let's get rid of vote by mail. It came in about 40 years ago, 1981 or so. There hasn't been a Republican governor elected since then. There has been just one statewide office filled with a Republican since then. I think it makes sense to get rid of it. And frankly, they all want to brag that, well, it's boosted voter involvement. No, it really hasn't. If you take a look at the votes in midterm elections and presidential election years, if you look at primaries and general elections, it really hasn't boosted participation much at all. And that's even when you factor in the fact that they now automatically register to vote everybody. They even try to, they register to vote 16-year-olds so they'll be all ready to go when they turn 18 and they can actually cast a ballot. In fact, the same people who will tell you all day long that most young people's brains don't mature until 26, the ones who said, but you have to let kids up to the age of, or above the age of 18 vote, these are the people who tell you we have to register people at 16. They're not going to be mature for another decade or so, so you can't blame them for anything bad that happens. But in the meantime, we want to make sure that they're all ready to cast a vote. And I don't think vote by mail has saved any money. I don't think it has dramatically increased the amount of participation. It is rife with opportunities for fraud. And if this was put to a vote, I'll bet you could get Oregonians to vote it down. I think you could do the same in Washington State. I think that vote by mail for representative government is a full-fledged train wreck. But that's my point of view. You can find the X poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, and always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, glad to be with you. Always glad to take your calls. Friday's X poll on First Amendment Friday. Should we abolish the TSA and replace it with private airport security? 83% of you said yes. A kind of surprising 17% said no. I was on the yes side of that one. I remember back after the 9/11 terrorist attacks when they said, well, we've got to dramatically increase the amount of security for America's airline industry. And I thought, yes, we do. But don't do it with another government agency. Well, they did. And the TSA, well, look, I know there are people in the TSA who work very hard to do their jobs, but they're working for a government agency. The beauty of privatizing airport security, and I don't have a dog in the fight on that one. I'm not involved in any kind of company that provides security. There is one airport in America that has private security. It still looks like TSA. It's just a private company. It's SFO, which is Nancy Pelosi's home airport in San Francisco. If you have private companies doing the job, you can fire them when they do a bad job. If you have government agencies doing a bad job, you know what happens? You don't fire them, you just give them more budget. Back in a moment, glad to get to your calls. And the Northwest nonsense is coming up next. Which one do you care more about, mutilating small children or monkeys in a lab? We'll get to that in just a moment on the Radio Northwest Network.
Okay, snowflakes, yes, you are probably going to be offended. This is the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense, a lot of nonsense.
Right, your body well right, you know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That Great Moment Every Day, where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Hey, if I asked you which one you care about more, monkeys in medical research or mutilating teenage children, most sensible folks would say the latter and not the former. So how do you understand the current controversy over Oregon Health and Science University and its primate center? For years, I've been arguing that powerful Democrats who control the House, the Senate, and the governor's office in Oregon should stop so-called gender-affirming care at OHSU. It is the polite euphemism that's used on Pill Hill to describe the ugly business of castrating and sterilizing children. Doctors do this to real kids based on horrific, discredited science that says if you don't cut off penises and breasts, children will end up killing themselves. OHSU and its medical Mengeles have ignored the evidence, and they keep on sterilizing kids. So has the state legislature and the governor. But now Democrat state officials have demanded that changes be brought at OHSU. Oh, not on the kids, not on the human beings, but in the treatment of research monkeys. Frankly, I think that necessary animal research to save human lives makes sense unless you can come up with a better way to get it done. If you can, then don't use the monkeys or whatever animal you're using. Mutilating kids in the name of LGBTQ and politics is monstrous. But monkeys mean more to the woke folks, and it tells you plenty about their priorities. Our question of the day is brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery, and get better fast. Find it at Multnomah Medical Clinic. Now, consider this. There's a story that broke about a week ago. It seems that some people in their garbage bins are not being picked up by the garbage company. And why? Because the garbage bins are filled with large plastic jugs with yellow fluid in them. What is that yellow fluid? It's urine, it turns out. And they're treating this like a mystery. I would suggest that there are probably two likely causes. If you see a big yellow apple juice jug by the side of I-5 or I-84, I can tell you that probably came from a truck driver. It could have been from somebody who's a non-truck driver, but my bet is truck drivers. What do you do when you find this same kind of stuff turning up in garbage bins in neighborhoods? Probably not a lot of 18-wheelers that like to drive through neighborhoods. I guess it's possible. But I got a note from a gentleman who said, no name, please. Thanks, Lars. He says, Lars, this is still going on, and it will. I have left two landscaping companies because their crews use water bottles as a toilet. And I've seen many full ones in the landscape trailers, and they mysteriously disappear at the end of the week. Oh, and 5-gallon buckets for the number two business. They weren't raised in America. It's common behavior elsewhere. No names, please. Thanks, Lars. Not a bad theory. The other theory I could throw in there, it could be homeless people. I mean, if you live in a tent and you don't want to do your business in the nearest bush, maybe it goes into a jar or a jug, and then it goes into somebody's neighborhood trash bin. The problem is, I can't imagine somebody hauling 4 or 5 jugs, milk jugs full of that, all the way to a neighborhood just to drop in the trash bin. My favorite post on X today, Elon Musk posted, IRS refund fraud payments are one of several means used by the Democrat Party to attract and retain illegal immigrants in the USA. That's why we're so opposed to DOGE stopping this. The Democrat Party is aiding and abetting fraudulent government payments to illegals in order to establish a permanent one-party majority nationally, just like they did in California. The more you look into it, the crazier it gets. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe you're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
I want to award today's Daily Grill to all the folks who are pushing the idea of what they call social housing. That is the new euphemism that replaces public housing, because when you say public housing to anybody, I don't care how conservative or liberal they are, public housing conjures up one kind of image. It is terrible. And now they want to call it social housing, because otherwise people would think, oh, you mean a hellhole that has to be rebuilt every 20 to 25 years. Number one. all government-built housing ends up costing 50% more than the private sector, although it does provide union jobs, and the unions love to donate to Democrat politicians. Number two, the government is notoriously bad at managing housing. Public housing immediately attracts crime and drug use, and law-abiding residents suffer when the government lacks the backbone to enforce the law. And public housing runs down very quickly and then has to be rebuilt. But again, you get to the union paychecks. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk at LarsLarson.com. It's brought to you by Mod Pods, a better alternative to tiny homes. They're customized living solutions in your own backyard without the customized cost. Find them online at GetModPod.com. Andrew writes in, Lars, the small burg of Bellingham, Washington does not have a housing crisis. How can that be? Because the policies the city enacted are designed to keep the supply small and increase the difficulty of investing in their community. They are reaping what they have sown. An opaque labyrinth to build would be hard to imagine. And there you have it. A man and a woman made a disaster designed to create the need for taxes to have affordable housing. And he points out the nightmare of regulations to build housing in the Northwest, not just Oregon, but Washington too. He said economists calculate that for West Coast cities like Bellingham, these restrictions roughly double the cost of housing, imposing a de facto regulatory tax of 100%. That is what makes our housing unaffordable. They made a mess, and they claim taxes are the answer. The mullahs of the People's Republic of Bellingham have spoken, signed Andrew. To your calls. Let's start out with Nancy. Hey, Nancy, welcome to Monday on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Oh, hi, Lars. Thank you. I just was very disappointed when President Trump called Justin Trudeau a soy boy. I mean, that's how my friends talk at work, and it's hilarious, but it sounds like he's hanging out with 20-year-olds like J.D. Vance and his son are kind of smart-ass kids, and I just didn't really like it.
The frat boy approach is not doing it for a lot of people, and I, as a fan of President Trump, I have to say that is not, it doesn't work for me either.
Yeah, you're a very eloquent speaker. You're, like, elegant, but yet you're not snotty ever. And there are other people who are elegant but snotty, and you know, you just can't help it, you speak well.
Well, you're kind to say that. You also called in about the using the DACA as cops. Should we have illegal aliens being cops?
It's frightening. You know, the criminals in the insane asylum, you know, taking over the asylum, it's insane. I mean, just, it's frightening.
These, by the way, crazy. By the way, back to your point about Trump, I've tried to emulate Winston Churchill. I think that guy had 1,000 ways to insult somebody without actually, you know, using, you know, terminology of 20-year-olds. And he was very, very clever. I mean, he described one politician he knew. He said, that man is a humble man, and he has much to be humble about. And I thought, okay, that's clever. You know, that's not soy boy.
Exactly.
And some of his were pretty punchy. I mean, they were almost like, okay, that conjures up. He basically called one woman a prostitute and just said, we're only negotiating the price. But he did it in such a classy way. He could do it to people with a smile on his face wearing black tie or tails. Nancy, thanks so much for the call. 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. The voice of the people. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. One of the subjects we talk about so much because it is so very important is education. Because in America, we provide a free education for those who choose to actually avail themselves of it. America spends more money per student per year on K through 12 education than every other country on earth. And we generally get worse results than many of the countries on earth. So I got this email the other day from David Wisniewski, who's a retired middle school teacher who's in the process of writing a book called Chalk Dust Elegy, an anecdotal retrospective of 50 years in an American public school classroom. And I thought maybe he could help us work out some solutions to this major problem. Mr. Wisniewski, welcome back to the program, or welcome to the program.
Hi, Lars. Good to be with you.
So tell me about this. Before I ask you anything, I want you to tell my audience, is America's education system the fine system it should be if we're spending the most money on planet Earth on public schools? And if it's not, how do we get it there?
My answer to that, Lars, would be absolutely not. Currently, the story of public education in America today is really the story of seven different groups working against each other rather than cooperating with each other. What I'm attempting to do is to assign or create a hierarchy of blame to figure out who's responsible for this. And we've got society, parents, teachers, universities, unions, school administration, students. They're all involved and they're all working against each other. Parents work against the teachers, the administration works against the teachers and the unions work against administration, and society works against all of them. And because they can't find a way to work together, we have the deteriorating situation that we have now.
I'm just curious about one of those. How do the parents work against the teachers?
Well,
I understand it's a pattern in America to say, well, everybody's part of the problem, but everybody can be part of the solution. But I'm curious, other than saying, I want my kid to be educated, what is the parent doing that works at cross purposes to the teacher?
Well, you know, one of the society enters into that. Parents are, they're really subject to the deterioration in society that all the rest of us are, that all these other groups are, and parental involvement, you know, when you think about it, it's the most uncontrollable factor other than societal interference. I had a principal who used to use the analogy of a three-legged stool, students, parents, and teachers, and if you cut the parental leg out from that stool, the stool's just going to collapse. I guess what I see more than anything is that parental interest really steadily erodes as a student moves through the grades. You know, it starts out really strong, first grade, second grade, in the primary years. But as things move along, parents tend to lose interest. You know, specifically, parents today, they actively model damaging things. They threaten consequences but don't follow through. And when students see that, when kids see that in their parents, they come to realize that threats are empty, and then that creates problems in the classroom. If parents model lack of respect for teachers, kids pick up on that, and they do the same thing. Parents also, they've gotten into protectionism so heavily today. You know, the old hot stove theory, they want to protect their kids from everything, and so their kids don't get to find out the dangers that confront them. They allow the task avoidance flu to go on. The kids aren't interested in doing things, and the parents protect them. And really, they promote selfishness and don't sacrifice the way that parents used to in the past.
I guess the only place I'd push back on that just a bit, and I don't really have a dog in the fight, my granddaughter is being homeschooled, and I think she's getting a much superior education. But when the parents are told by the schools, you have no business telling us what to teach your kids. And they've been told that overtly. There was a guy who ran for governor of Virginia, and I thought he was going to win, Terry McAuliffe. He was a terrible candidate, but he came out and just said, parents have no business telling teachers or the schools what to do. And we've heard it in 1,000 different ways when parents show up at school board meetings with reasonable complaints, saying, my kid got hurt at school because you let somebody assault my kid, and then you did nothing to the assaultive kid. That's a reasonable complaint. If they said, you're reading pornography or providing pornography to my kid in school, those are all things that could be reasonably acted on by the principal, by the individual teachers, by the librarians, by the school board, and all of them say, you have no business telling us what to do. And when parents say, hey, this curriculum is terrible, You're bringing all this politics to the classroom, and you're not teaching my kid how to read or do math. And that's a reasonable complaint. I think you'd agree. And yet the schools say, yeah, you don't get to tell us what we teach your kids. And when you get that message enough, I don't blame parents for not being involved. If they're told, you can come down and we'll assign you the scut work jobs, you know, making copies of something or, you know, riding herd on kids when the teacher's out of the classroom. But other than that, you got nothing to say about how we teach your kids. Why would you want to be involved in a group which tells you, we're happy to have you do the grunt work, but you don't really have a say in what we do, even though the parents probably have more of a say, along with other taxpayers, about what public education ought to be, and yet the folks in the system say, no, you can't tell us what to do.
Lars, I have absolutely no pushback on that. I agree with you 100% that no school district ever has any call to tell parents that they should not be involved in what their children are learning. Okay, I don't agree with a lot of the things that are going on inside classrooms today, with the way instructional minutes are being used, you know, with the whole DEI thing and transgender this and transgender education that, and the kind of books and things like that students are being exposed to. I guess when it comes to parents, I was always very involved with my children's education, you know, being a teacher, and my wife and I actively took a part in wanting our kids placed with specific teachers because we understood our kids' learning styles. And I think for parents to be more vocal, I think one way they could be vocal that would really show that they have an interest in what's going on is not so much just to keep in contact with teachers, but to take a hand in showing administration that they are interested in having that they understand the learning styles of their own kids and what their own kids need.
That's reasonable.
Yes, and actually opening up a dialogue with administration and showing that they're interested in having their kids placed with the right kind of teachers. You know, parents don't realize that they can do that kind of thing. I have never been part of a district where if a parent came in and actually gave the administration reasons for why they wanted this for their students or why they wanted that for their students, that the administration wouldn't acquiesce to that kind of thing.
David, we're going to have you back another time, but I guess that would be like saying, Lars, when you go to the hospital, be sure and ask them to give you the right doctor. And I say, how do I get that information? Well, if you work in the hospitals, you worked in the system, you'd say, this guy's really good, that guy wouldn't trust him with an aspirin. And you say, well, how are you going to know that? Well, if you don't work in the system, you have no way of knowing it. You have no way of knowing that Mr. Johnson is just counting the hours to retirement, but Mrs. Smith is great when it comes to teaching math. That's David Wisnaski. He's a retired middle school teacher. He's writing a book, and we're going to talk to him about that at some point down the line. Glad to have your calls. It's a Monday, and coming up in a moment, will some conservative group or individual buy that Uncle Sam billboard next to I-5? We'll talk about that.
You can't fix stupid.
Stupid is forever.
But you surely can vote them out. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. It's Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and this segment comes from 540training.com. Concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense. Find them online at 540training.com. Our X-Poll question today. There's a bill that's been introduced in the Oregon legislature. I wish Washington would do the same. I know it's been introduced by a Republican, David Brock Smith. That means it has almost zero chance of getting passed by the House and Senate, which are under the thrall of Democrat supermajorities, has almost no chance of being signed by Governor Tina Kotek, who's a tried and true Democrat, and she understands what vote by mail means. It means the Democrats can cheat all day long and that you'll never see another Republican elected. But at least David Brock Smith has proposed the idea. should the states end vote by mail? I'd vote yes on that. I'd like to see it put to a public vote and an honest discussion of what it does, what it doesn't do, and about the opportunities it opens up for fraud. You can find the question at Lars Larson Show, and always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. To your calls now, let's start off with Jim. Hey, Jim, welcome to the program. What's on your mind on this fine Monday?
Well, I just wanted to thank you for mentioning the boycott against that merger of OHSU and the Legacy Health. And not because of the, as you stated and as clearly stated, the butchering of children, but the testing and the killing of monkeys.
Yep.
That's the breaking point isn't the children being butchered irreversibly. It's about monkeys. And then the people that allow the commercials to be played on the various radio stations and take that money. The first question out of their mouth should have been, okay, you don't like monkeys being butchered and killed. What about children? Where do you stand on that?
I'd love that to be. And by the way, as I understand it, the ads are not going to be running anymore. And I've had plenty of people target me. And I say, I don't, other than the ads I put my name on, you know, my endorsements, the ads that are run by the radio stations on the RNW network are not my, they're not in my wheelhouse, they're not under my authority. So, but I think it would be great if they did say, well, you know, if you're worried about monkeys, what about the kids? I think probably, though, the PETA types are probably not the kind of people who are worried about butchering kids. They're probably in favor of it, which tells you something about their bizarre priorities. I mean, if you were having a conversation with somebody and he or she was going on and on about the monkeys aren't treated right and sometimes they're abused in medical research, and then ask the person, well, what do you think about, you know, gender change surgery and hormone treatments that permanently sterilize children? If they say, oh, no, that's appropriate, that tells you everything you need to know about that person, I think.
Yeah, what the doctors are doing is they're creating a lifetime patient, because there is no possibility to change a boy to a girl or vice versa, so it's going to be doctor visit after doctor visit, hormones after hormones, whatever they have to do. But again, they've created a lifetime patient for barbaric reasons.
And by the way, Jim, you know, there are people who are legitimately concerned about things in our food or things elsewhere. And you say, I'm worried about red dye number 5. Great. Because you know that it may have a lifetime effect. You're worried about people getting sunburned or sun exposure because you know that in 20 or 30 years, you may get cancer out of it. What's the lifetime effect of taking a boy and putting him on hormones to try to emulate a girl? As you point out, you can't recreate the girl. You can't create a girl out of a boy or vice versa. But what's the lifetime effect of taking hormones forever? Probably something significant. Do we know what it is yet? No, but we're just doing, as Dr. Blair Peters of OHSU said, we're kind of figuring it out as we go along. And he's one of the guys who makes money. I forget what his pronoun is, but he's one of the guys who makes money on this gender affirmation nonsense. And if you asked him, well, do you know what this is going to do to my kid long term? Even if you're a transgender true believer, should you be concerned that putting those chemicals in your kid's body for the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years is going to have an adverse effect? And if you're not worried about that, then I think you're more concerned about virtue signaling than anything else. Let's go to Bill. Hey, Bill, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. I just read this morning, to my utter astonishment, that a French highest court has prevented Marine Le Pen, head of the front-running Conservative Party, National Front, Front National, from running in 2027 for president.
She's banned for 5 years for what they called embezzlement. And, Bill, do you know how bizarre this is? So Marine Le Pen is involved in partisan politics in France, and she's a member of the European Parliament, which is the parliament for the whole EU, the European Union. And they say, you stole because some of your legislative aides for the European Union were used to do work on political party matters in France. I'm not even sure how you divide those up. I mean, if you make somebody a member of the European Parliament and say you have a staff, well, what are they allowed to do? Well, they're allowed to do stuff that has to do with the European Parliament. Well, does that include being involved in political matters in France, the country I'm representing, on the EU Parliament? how in the world would you divide those two up?
Exactly, but that follows in a pattern. The same thing, copy-paste what happened in Romania regarding Georgescu, and it just like J.D. Vance was so right that the Europe has been starting to suppress democracy when a conservative frontrunner from president is being banned or prevented from running. And do you think that President Trump should basically sanction any country such as Romania, France? They were trying to do the same thing regarding the election.
I think he might be tempted. He's been the subject of lawfare as well.
Lars Larson.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network. Lars and now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and your emails. We'll do that in just a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Now, I invited Josh Marquis on, former DA, board member of the Oregon Criminal Justice Truth Project. I want to hit a bunch of different topics, though, Josh. Number one, are people going to have to say goodbye to Oregon's version of constitutionally protected free speech if the legislature has its way?
I would never have said yes, because for over 40 years we've had a special relationship with the First Amendment. Meaning, in Oregon, that's why nude dancing was allowed. It was the Oregon Supreme Court held that it was absolutely protected by the Oregon's First Amendment. And I don't really care that much about nude dancing, but there are other crimes that are sometimes affected by it. But there seems to be a measure by, of course, the ruling Democratic Party to take that away and start creating protected classes of people who you can't even say bad things about. We all agree that somebody shouldn't be able to do bad things to people. But it's a very different matter if you start, as George Orwell would say, making bad speak illegal.
Yeah, and yet that's what they're talking about doing. Because, Josh, just so people understand, the bill that's before the legislature right now would say, if you harass somebody who is a government employee, whether they're an elected government employee like a governor or a senator or a rep, or whether they're just a plain vanilla government employee, you know, who does some job within the state bureaucracy.
DMV, whatever.
You could say, I think DMV is terrible. I don't like DMV. I don't like the people that work there. That if you merely engage in continuously criticizing them, that can be a criminal matter. But if the DMV worker criticizes a regular citizen, that they have lesser rights to any kind of protection. Is that the gist of it?
That is essentially right. The difference is that, you know, the United States is unique in the world in having a true First Amendment. Even in places like Britain, Canada, Western Europe, there are things that the police can put you in jail for just saying. And I'm not talking about
or even thinking prayer, for example, silent prayer.
But the United States, because of our founding fathers, that was never true. And Oregon even took it further. But what they're claiming is there was a hearing before the legislature, and a judge, I think he was a court of appeals judge, got up and wept about how all the terrible things people were saying about him, and that he had to explain to his wife. You know, part of this I have no sympathy for. I was an elected official for 25 years. There were entire websites devoted to how awful I was, how awful my wife was, and you know what? I got elected. I had to put up with it. There's a famous old quote, your right to swing my fist ends where my nose begins.
Right.
But underneath that is the swing without the intent to do harm is not criminal, and it should never be. This is
maybe even if you intend to do harm. I mean, by harm, I mean verbally, if I criticize Tina Kotek, if I criticize Kate Brown, if I criticize Jay Inslee or now Bob Ferguson, I may intend that people think less of them, you know, and say, if my criticisms are legitimate, you know, and I say, or if I say Val Hoyle, I think member of Congress, member of the Democrat Party, steered a half a million taxpayer dollars to a private company that then put money in a bag and gave to her. And so if you say, wow, people are going to think she's horrible, I say, good, they should. And even if my intent is to harm them by saying true things about them that make them look bad, is that not legitimate American free speech?
Well, I think it is legitimate. I mean, I've spent over 45 years as a prosecutor, and it was frustrating at times when people did offensive things, stood outside someone's house at 3 o'clock in the morning, shouted obscenities at them. But guess what? Under Oregon's version of free speech, unless there is imminent violence, the inconvenience is not a crime. And what's spooky about this is because all of a sudden we're creating new protected classes, public employees, more public employees, people who will get their feelings hurt, people who will get their feelings more hurt. Again, look, it's rude to say things like that to people. And we, in an ideal world, people would not be abusive. And do I think there's too much abusive behavior? Of course there is. But the idea of making it a crime to basically, write something on the internet, saying, you know, this person really sucks, maybe something even really, really bad takes. That goes at the absolute core at the First Amendment.
I mean, if somebody wants to stand out in front of a DMV, we picked on them, and they're an agency that gets picked on, but say, these people provide terrible service. And if you want to stand out there with a sign or give speeches, and every time a DMV worker shows up, you yell at them. You don't put them in fear of their life, but you criticize them. So what? And if you don't want that, go to work somewhere else, because the citizens especially have a right to criticize people who work in government and deliver less than desired results. Let me ask you about something else. I don't think I'll go outside your range because of your crazy last name. You've got some French background in you. I want to know what you think of taking Marine Le Pen, who is the odds on to win the presidency next time in France, and saying, you are forbidden to run for office. I know she hasn't embraced Donald Trump much, but it sure smacks of the kind of lawfare, saying, we can't beat you at the polls, the voters love you, but we're going to make sure you can't run for office. And that's what they've done to her.
Well, I'm actually not French. I'm actually Polish, but that's a long story.
Okay.
But I do know a lot about French politics. And Marie Le Pen is a very right-wing person. I would not vote for her.
God bless her.
A lot of French think that way. She did very, very well. But absent, you know, actual crimes like bribing officials, the idea that you start, I mean, the kind of countries that just basically put people on the you cannot vote for list, you know, you're really handing away.
Well, and let me ask it. Let me make it personal, because I do this to callers all the time. Josh, when you were DA in Clatsop County, did you ever have your staff work on things, cases that did not involve Clatsop County, but did involve people from other counties? Did you ever do that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Were you embezzling from the taxpayers of Clatsop County because they gave you a budget to deal with crimes in Clatsop County? There's nothing in your marching orders that says, and work on stuff from Multnomah County or even from Washington State. They didn't do that. That's what she got convicted of. They said you embezzled because you used some of your EU parliamentary staff to work on things in France that related to your representation of France on the EU Parliament.
Well, it's absurd. And, of course, that, you know, he who disturbeth his own house shall inherit the wind, as in Ecclesiastes. And, you know, the fact of the matter is a lot of countries in Western Europe are voting for much more conservative. I wouldn't vote that way. I don't like it. But you either believe in democracy or you don't.
Well, you're coming around, Josh. You get more conservative every month that goes by, and we appreciate that. Josh Marquis, former DA, now member of the board of the Criminal Justice Truth Project. Back in a moment.
A reminder, you are in control.
Our Constitution is a document in which we, the people, tell the government what it is allowed to do.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I want to talk about icebreakers just a bit. I read this fascinating piece over the weekend, and it's all about America and how it has a certain number of icebreakers, one or two of them, and we need to have more of them. And why? Because they serve a function, especially with the Arctic. And you say, okay, what do you pay for a new icebreaker? Well, if you're a country like Finland, which President Trump has met with recently, their last icebreaker, almost a decade ago, cost about $125 million. A lot of money. It's a big ship. And how much does their newest icebreaker cost? About $250 million. So about 6 years ago, a company was awarded a contract to build three of what they call polar security cutters. They're giant icebreakers. And the contract went to a company that's in Pascagoula, Mississippi. And it's called VT Halter Marine. And I read this fascinating piece by Amuse on X. Great journalism. I wish I could reach out to the guy and get him or her to come on the show. But this was amazing because they said, okay, we need to build three of these babies. Deliver one of them. The promised price was $745.9 million for that ship. Now, remember, Finland pays about $250 million, about one-third the cost to get the same kind of ship. And I would argue that I'm sure that some things are different between Finland and the United States, but I'd be willing to bet that paychecks are probably not dramatically different. Environmental regs are probably not in gigantically different between Finland and the United States. We're not talking about a third world nation. So what happened with the VT Halter contract? Well, one thing I feel necessary to mention to you is that VT Halter, while it's based in Pascagoula, Mississippi, is in fact a company owned by a company that's based in Singapore. It's not an American company. It's owned by a foreign company. So they were supposed to supply the very first of the icebreakers, and the delivery date was last year, 2024. Did they actually deliver the ship? They did not. They now say it likely won't be delivered until 2030, about 5.5 years from now. Well, 4.5 years anyway. So, and how much is the cost? Is it still $745 million? Well, you know, things have gone up dramatically in cost. They now say that the ship is going to cost $1.7 billion, and that by the time they're done building three of these babies, that the total cost is going to be over $5 billion. But they're saying that today. Now, imagine if the difference in cost from 6 years ago to today is double, more than double. It goes from $745 million to $1.7 billion, more than double in 6 years. How much is the cost going to increase in the next 6 years? And the way Amuse put it, and I thought he came up with a great metaphor, and I love great metaphors. He said, imagine a scenario. You pay a contractor $1.7 billion for three new homes. 5 years go by. You still have no home, not even one of the three. And worse, you're told it's going to be another 5 years, and the final cost is now going to go to $5 billion. Meanwhile, your neighbor offers to sell you ready-made homes of a superior quality for about one-fifth of that price, and they'll be delivered in 24 months. Would you continue with your original contractor? And as he says, of course not. The reasonable person would say no. And it kind of reminded me of an old movie about the presidency called Dave. And it was a feature film. It was not a documentary. But it imagined that a guy who is a presidential impersonator, I think it was Kevin Kline, ends up impersonating the president for a few weeks. And along the way, he decides to cut the federal budget. And there's a conversation that he has that's now become quite popular on social media, places like Instagram, where Dave, the guy who's the stand-in for the president, is asking a general, you know, one of the folks from the Pentagon, so we have a contract with this company to deliver X, and they're not delivering it, but we're still paying them? And he says, should we still be paying them? And the general admits, no, it doesn't make sense to keep paying people when they haven't actually done the work that they promised to do. But let me point this out as well, because I thought Amuse on X was actually right. He says DEI may have had a lot to do with why this contract went to this company, VT Halter, the company that's owned by the Singapore company. Well, how would diversity, equity, and inclusion play a role in that? And what he explains is when they went out to bid the contract, get the contract bid, VT Halter was not at the top of the list. They had a history, he says, of underperformance, and I went and checked a couple of other sources. Turns out that's correct, including cost overruns and delivery delays. Now, does that say, well, if you've got a company and you give them the contract, and 6 years later you have no ships and you have news from the company that the ship they are going to build sometime in the next 6 years is going to cost more than twice as much, it sounds like they're living right up to their reputation. They say it was not chosen for its track record of building polar class vessels because it had no track record for building icebreakers, nor for speed and nor for cost efficiency. So why did they get the contract to begin with? Well, it turns out they have a very good record when it comes to DEI, because under previous administrations, DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion, which means you hire people not based on their skills and abilities, you hire them based on them being the right skin color. You hire them based on the right pronouns. You hire them based on being the right gender. Maybe they say you have to hire more women. Okay, that's fine. If they're competent, I've got no argument with that whatsoever. But if you say we're hiring people because they check certain boxes for our federal government, which under a whole bunch of administrations going back at least as far as Obama and probably beyond that, we've had federal government contracts that are assigned to people because they check certain boxes, because they say we have a generous number of women as well as men. We have a generous number of gay as well as straight. We have a generous number of people who can't figure out their sexuality, so they become non-binary or they become transgender or whatever. But when you let contracts to companies on that basis, he says in 2016, Finlanders, the Finnish ship called Polaris, was delivered for less than $150 million. Today, they could build that same vessel for $250 million and deliver it within two years. They have shipyards, they have skilled labor, they have technical expertise. Now, I'm for buying American every chance you get. Am I so buy American that I would say, no, don't buy that $250 million icebreaker from a Finland company. Buy it from an American company that, by the way, is owned by that company in Singapore. It's not an American-owned company, but at least the jobs will go to Pascagoula, Mississippi, instead of going to Finland. But we're going to buy it for three times the price. Well, that was the original bid. Now it's $1.7 billion, so it's about seven times as much cost. Is DEI important enough that you would say it doesn't matter? We have to buy double, triple, quadruple, quintuple, whatever it happens to be. We are going to buy that ship, and it's going to be made in America by a company that's actually owned by a company from Singapore. If any of that makes sense, I'd be glad to take the naysayer calls at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails in a moment. But first, now that even those in Gaza want Hamas, the terrorist group, out of Gaza, should other countries come to the aid of Israel and help them get the job done? Now, that we'd talk about that with Rabbi Yaakov Menken, who's executive vice president at the Coalition for Jewish Values, the largest rabbinic public policy organization in America. Rabbi, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
We could actually achieve a lot, couldn't we, if Hamas is removed as the de facto government of Gaza, which is what our intelligence agencies say it is, and is what the voters of Gaza made it about 15 years, close to 20 years ago now. Is it possible that you could de-Hamas the Gaza Strip And does it involve, you know, the necessity to move these people elsewhere? And should some of the other Arab countries take part in that?
The denazification of Gaza is going to take time, the same way that it happened over years in Germany. First, they had to make the party illegal. It was illegal to support the Nazis. Then they were able to move on. Right now, you definitely have a movement on the street in Gaza. There was footage of children. Right now is a Muslim holiday with the end of Ramadan, and Hamas fighters were hiding among children. And openly, the adults and the children were condemning Hamas for their involvement, for embedding themselves among children. This is, of course, what Hamas has been doing all the way along. And the international community has just turned a blind eye. Why do they imagine that Hamas is hiding them, putting their tunnels, putting their fighters underneath civilian buildings with the exits in mosques, in hospitals, and in schools? Well, all of that is being done because the useful idiots of the West blame Israel for the result of these crimes. It is time for the international community to join with Gazans who are fed up with Hamas and get these people out.
Okay, so but how do you do that in practical terms? Because in Germany, you kind of had to, it wasn't like, well, some people, an awful lot of people ended up, you know, leaving Western Europe and coming to the United States and other places. But how do you do it with a tiny little piece of real estate like the Gaza Strip?
The Gaza Strip is not as tiny as people imagine.
Okay, then I'm wrong about that.
No,
but Rabbi, when I think of 5 miles by 25 miles, that sounds like a postage stamp.
You know, it may, but when you're dealing with very much precision munitions, there really are opportunities, and of course the Israelis have been doing this throughout, moving people away from combat areas to the best of their ability, to the point where the only people remaining are the fighters and their human sacrifices. We don't even call them human shields. They are anxious to die for the cause, and so therefore they're just human sacrifices to the gods of Hamas. And it absolutely is possible to move these people out of harm's way, including into Egypt. They just have to be willing to go.
And Egypt has to be willing to take them. And will some of these other countries, you and I have talked about this before, that Egypt has said, we put up a wall that, like the kind of wall America should have on our southern border. And I've seen pictures of this thing. Egypt was serious about saying, we don't want those people here. Can you get them to change that?
There is some sort of movement within in Egypt as far as taking a certain number of Gazan civilians temporarily. The problem is that the Gazans have been so indoctrinated to hate, and so much of the Arab world has built their lives around this myth that the Palestinian refugee is a problem that Israel has to solve. You know, Israel took in 850,000 refugees. They're all Israelis today. We call them Israelis because they were Jews. We don't leave them as refugees. Every refugee crisis in the world ends except for the Palestinian crisis. Palestinians still have refugees 80 years later. That's a problem. And that's a problem that the Arab world has created. The Arab world is going to have to deal with the problem of these indoctrinated, hateful individuals who are Arabs just like them. They're their neighbors. And they're going to have to take them back in because, unfortunately, there's no other way forward.
Well, is there anything to be gained, for example, by taking some of the countries that you and I have talked about, Egypt, Jordan, Kuwait, and a few others, and saying, are you willing to take some part of this population, if they want to relocate to your place, work jobs, you know, sustain themselves, etc., would you take them in as long as they promise that they're not going to import Hamas terrorism or Hamas ideology to your country?
Well, it's not as if Kuwait doesn't start off from anti-Semitic mythology to begin with. I mean, this is a country, the Kuwait Airlines stopped flying to the United States because the United States says you can't deny boarding to a guy with an Israeli passport. Seriously, Kuwait Airlines will not fly to Dulles or anywhere else in the United States, because to do so, they would have to allow Israeli citizens to board the plane. And, of course, if you're Jewish, you just don't get it.
Well, and not only that, but, Rabbi, I was told, I mean, I'm a Christian. I'm a Protestant Christian. But I have a passport, and I was told, well, you know, you've been to Israel a few times. There's a stamp in there. I said, and they said, show up in certain Arab countries with that stamp in your passport, and you're going to earn a bunch of trouble. Is that
That's
still true?
That's absolutely true. I mean, this is definitely still true. It is all about, you know, the indoctrination and the level of anti-Semitism that is taken for granted in these countries. I mean, you have actual bad actors. It's amazing how the so-called pro-Palestinian, like, your pro-Hamas protesters on campus, they don't actually care about Palestinians. None of them are protesting that an Arab identified as a Palestinian living in Lebanon is not allowed to live outside a refugee camp and not allowed to get a white-collar job or a serious advanced education. Those doors are closed to them in Lebanon. Nobody is bothered that even in the Palestinian Authority itself, if a person is living in a refugee camp, they built an entire city not long ago and said, but those who are living in refugee camps cannot move into that city. They can't get out of the refugee camp and into solid homes, because then all of a sudden, well, you know, then we're at peace. Then we don't have a problem that Israel has to solve.
And, you know, one of the most eye-openers for me, Rabbi, and I can't remember, it was in, I can't remember the town, but they had set up a light industrial district, right? And I said, how many people work here? And they said about 6,000. I said, how many are Palestinians? They said about 3,000. I said, how many are Jews? And he said about 3,000. So it's half and half. I said, should I assume that if I walked into one of these small businesses that are manufacturing things, that the Jew is going to be the one in charge? They said, oh, no. You know, about half the time, the Palestinian is the guy who's the supervisor, the director, the manager, whatever, and it's Jews who are working for him. He said, on the other hand, the Palestinian, the Jews can go home, you know, to their home and say, this is where I work. They said the Palestinians cannot afford to tell most people where they actually have their day job, even though it pays a whole lot better than what they would have in the PA, because if they do, they might end up getting killed or hurt. And I said, that's stunning, and I'll bet most Americans aren't aware of that.
That's absolutely true. And by the way, recently there were anti-Hamas protests in Gaza, and Hamas rounded up and killed the leaders of those protests. So, unsurprisingly, they died out along with their leaders. I mean, that's how it works in a lot of these governments and the totalitarian nature of the thing. But absolutely, there's a company called SodaStream that you self-made carbonation. Yep. And it used to be located in one of those industrial districts where you described, where Jews and Arabs worked alongside each other, and it was a wonderful place, and they got the same salaries and based on experience, etc. And then, because of all the protests, SodaStream decided, oh, okay, we give up. We won't be located there. We're going to move to the Negev. And, of course, when they move to the Negev, they can't employ the Arabs from Palestinian Authority anymore.
No, they can't. That's Rabbi Yaakov Menken from the Coalition for Jewish Values. Back in a moment. Glad to get your calls. 866-HEY-LARS. You got the Lars Larson.
The 40th President of the United States always knew where to put the blame.
You have blamed mistakes of the past, and you blamed the Congress. Does any of the blame belong to you?
Yes, because for many years I was a Democrat.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you. This segment of the show brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showings, no hassles, and you get to pick the closing date. NickShivers.com gets you the details on that. Our X poll today, should states and vote by mail. Now, the irony there would be that you'd probably have to have a vote of the voters by vote by mail to get rid of vote by mail. And beyond the problem of trying to pass Senate Bill 210, which has been introduced by a Republican by the name of David Brock Smith, he's a member of the Oregon Senate, Chances are that bill isn't going to go anywhere because you've got Democrats in charge of both houses of the legislature and the governor's office and every other statewide elected office. And it's pretty much been that way ever since vote by mail went in almost 40 years ago. But they did get a public hearing on the bill to repeal Oregon's vote by mail system. And it'll be interesting to see what kind of testimony they get. I would be interested to see what kind of vote, because I had any number of emails from people who heard about the X-Poll and said, Lars, you're never going to get that through because they'll just cheat. I said, then you have to do it the way Trump did it. If you win big enough, they can't cheat. Today's X-Poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Let's go to Ron in Salem. Hey, Ron, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Lars, as of 12:30 today, Senate Bill 1098, to vote 18-10 with two excused absences, passed out of the Senate.
This is the one on book bans, so-called book bans, which are not really book bans?
Yes, sir. It's basically enabling pornography curriculum,
yep,
and also pictures that's more graphic than I've ever seen.
Some of the books that are in front of, to Ron's point, some of the books that are being put in front of your kids in public schools in Oregon are not just full of words, but they are in fact graphic novels, and graphic doesn't even begin to describe the kind of pictures that your kids are being exposed to in the libraries of their schools and even in the classrooms. And now Salem has said to local communities, you're not allowed to tell the librarian not to put that book on the shelf.
Yes, sir, and in curriculum to your second graders on down. Here's where the score on public testimonies is very essential, that the people, the churches that has children or grandkids or even mentor kids or foster parents, we had 980 that have supported this bill. 980 people, wow, against 151, Lars, in public testimony that was submitted on this bill. This is disturbing. I'm not trying to be conspiracy theorist, Lars, but when you got a person that was arrested 2 weeks ago down in Coos Bay for just showing pictures to a minor,
yep,
aren't we enabling the same type of behavior?
Yes.
And is it possibly why they want to go through and have these other sex offender bills sort of softened up, just like Measure 110?
I think it's worse, Ron, and here's why. If some pervert freak out there shows dirty pictures to your kid, that's bad. He should be caught. He should be indicted. He should be prosecuted, and punishment should come for contributing the sexual delinquency of minor or charges like that. When somebody who's in a position of authority, I mean, most kids respect their teachers, they respect the school, they respect the principal. When those people and the school board say, it's okay to put this stuff in front of kids, that sends an even more powerful message to the kids. This isn't some dirty old man on the street corner. This is the teacher. This is the school saying this stuff's okay. I think in that case, you have an even greater potential for really damaging that kid.
Yes, we do. But we have one more chance, Lars. We have one more chance by the hand of God. And thank God for our founding fathers, because this really affects me, Lars, as a foster kid who's seen other kids who've gone through worse than I have. In California, if the Republicans and the people in these communities do not stand up and rebuke this proposed normalcy that they want to put upon our kids when they're having problems reading, writing, arithmetic, then we've just gone down the road of Auschwitz in some cases in the wrong way.
Well, you're going to be indoctrinating kids to exactly the wrong things. Ron, thank you very much. I appreciate the call. Let's go to Rhonda. Hey, Rhonda, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind? Hey, Rhonda. Well, it sounds like Rhonda gave up. Oh, maybe her phone gave up. I'm sorry about that, Rhonda. Maybe better luck next time. Glad to be with you and always glad to take your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Great piece that I saw out of Bellingham, which is up toward the north, not too far from the Canadian border in the northwest, about single family zoning. This is the point of view of the left. You know that the Pacific Northwest has a gigantic problem supplying enough housing. And the end result of that is the price of a house has gone out of reach of most average people. The cost of even renting housing, like an apartment or a rental house, that is also similarly going out of reach. And yet, what you get is things like this op-ed by Andrew Redding in Bellingham. He says they're restricting people in the kind of housing they're allowed to get because cities are beginning to restrict density and promote sprawl. I don't consider it sprawl. I know that's popular. You sit in a city and you say, oh, everything here must look just like what I'm looking at now. No, no. You should allow people to buy the kind of housing that fits their needs. If that's a single family house in a single family neighborhood, let them buy it, let them rent it. If it's an apartment unit, that's what they want, that's fine. But telling people we're going to force this stuff on you, that is not government's job.
The Lars Larson Show.
Ladies and gentlemen,
you ready for the mix?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars
and now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network on this Monday. We aim to serve the needs of the Pacific Northwest states, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, and we talk about the issues of the day. And one of them is whether or not citizens have any role in actually deciding what their government does. And we cite almost daily examples where government says, we're going to have a public hearing. We'll listen to public testimony. We'll take note of it. We'll file it away. And then we'll do whatever we plan to do. Or in Washington state, where citizens get together 400,000 signatures on a petition, they put it to a vote. The public votes yes. And the courts come in and reverse that and make it no instead. And then consider what's going on in Oregon right now, where Oregon, apparently, those in charge want to cripple the right of citizen initiative petitions. And Jason Williams joins me now, founder of the Taxpayer Association of Oregon. Jason, welcome back.
Yes, sad circumstances that the politicians actually have a bill this week that would basically shut down the initiative process by making it extremely more difficult to put a measure on the ballot. So if the politicians, if this becomes law, and the politicians decide to take your ticker, well, you're not going to be able to challenge it. Or if they decide to take away the Second Amendment for Oregonians, you're not going to be able to challenge it with a petition because they've set the signature threshold so high under this bill, and they've created this six-jurisdictional network where signatures have to come proportionately from different districts. It basically will make it impossible unless you have $2 million to put a measure on the ballot, and that's just criminal.
By the way, you're talking about Senate Joint Resolution 30, and let's go through the specific things it does. Can you put a tax cut on the ballot?
You would have to get extra signatures to be able to do that, and you have to get signatures from these different quadrants. So if you happen to get too many signatures on the east side of town but not on the west side of a town, then those signatures are voided. Even though you are a voter and you sign that petition, your signature gets crossed out because there's too many from one area and not enough from another. And this is why it's just going to wipe out the initiative petition process.
I mean, Jason, neither one of us is an attorney, but I think both of us have enough familiarity with election law. The laws of the United States and the law in the state of Oregon, the constitutional right, is that we all have to be treated equally, and there can't be special classes of citizens. That's the state constitutional limit, which means you can't say we're going to trust votes more from, say, Harney County than we do from Lane County or Multnomah County, or vice versa. You're not allowed to create classes of citizens. Doesn't this create a class by saying you must get this many signatures, but they have to be evenly distributed across a given area?
Yeah, and it's crazy. You know, when I put a measure on the ballot, a campaign, no fake emergencies, we had $700,000 we raised over 150,000 signatures, and we came up short. Now the fact that they want to raise these even higher, it makes it impossible. And we got to figure out, you know, it's a one-party rule here in the state. One party controls 60% of the House and 60% of the Senate and the governor's office. The only avenue we have left to say no and to bring up our own ideas is the initiative process. So that's why, you know, there's a hearing this Wednesday. Details are on a link on OregonWatchdog.com. People need to, and people, I want to let people know, you can submit online testimonies. You don't even need to leave your chair. You could do it online straight through the Capitol Network. And when it comes to taking away the initiative process, this is our free speech. A lot of great things came through the initiative process. The limits on your property taxes came through that way. In the 1990s, we sent criminals behind bars for a long time because voters had to use the initiative process to put it to the voters because the politicians would not keep criminals behind bars. So a lot of measures passed in the 90s. The kicker was put into the state law, and then they had to put it in the Constitution to keep the politicians' hand on it. Everything we love, many of the things we love came through the initiative process, and I don't want to see this go away, Lars.
And by the way, the numbers are stunning, because let me start with this, Jason. Is it frequently the case that we will see people elected to office or tax measures passed where the total turnout is relatively low, which means the part that the winning side or the winning candidate gets are even lower than that? So you might have 30% of the voters turn out, and if somebody gets 16%, they become the winner. And yet here, just to put something on the ballot, you have to collect signatures they've increased the number by 25%. So what does that do in practical terms? How many signatures does somebody have to gather? And then how many do you need to be safe in that number to be able to just put a statutory change on the ballot?
Well, I think a statutory change right now is maybe 80, 90,000. But you really need to get like 120,000 because they disqualify a lot of signatures based on technicalities and a lot of crazy rules. So even though you're trying to get 100,000, you got to get an extra bonus 20,000. If this thing passes, well, then now you're adding another 20,000 to it or so. So it's making it only so that the richest people in Oregon who can spend $2 million to put a measure on the ballot. Now, the lawmakers can send things to the ballot. We've been having a lot of measures sent by lawmakers. All they need is a 51% vote. It's easy for them. They don't need to spend a dime. They just vote and can send all they want to the ballot. We have to go right now spend nearly $1 million, gather over 100,000 signatures to get on the ballot.
Jason, yeah. all you're really trying to do by gather signatures is say there's sufficient public interest in having a vote on this to make it worthwhile. So you don't have, say, dozens or hundreds of votes that are taken where you say, I want to vote on this and I want to vote on that, and I've got 20 people on a petition. That's not much of a statement. But saying you've got to have a certain number of signatures to be able to put the thing on the ballot, are we being overrun with initiative petitions? What's the justification to put this kind of limit on it?
The politicians do not like when voters have brought things to the ballot. They don't like the kicker. They don't like property tax limits. These are the bills that they're trying to have hearings right now. They're trying to take the kicker that voters put into the Constitution. They're trying to undo the property rights limits that are there and the property tax limits. That's why the politicians don't like when voters come out and they do it their own way and they do it the right way. And so that's why they're saying, well, let's just shut that down. Let's make it next to impossible to put a measure on the ballot.
Last quick question. Has Governor Kotek said she'll sign this thing if it passes the legislature?
Well, because it's a referral, because it's in the Constitution, the lawmakers are going to have to refer this bad idea to the public. But I don't want to have a big campaign fighting for my right of free speech. This is the most unnecessary thing. Our petition process has been around for 120 years, one of the first in the United States. 120 years, Now they kind of want to shut it down because it's like, I don't like what's on the ballot, the politicians say.
No, and in that case, you had things like driver's licenses for illegals, endorsed by the legislature, rejected by the public, and you end up getting it anyway. Back in a moment.
Jew.org.
Gun Control Explained.
Want to stop drunk drivers from killing sober drivers? Ban sober drivers. That's how gun control works.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I got to tell you about something. There has been more information that has gone out to American citizens about the crazy ways that our federal government, and I would think state governments as well, spend our money. And I think back to the days when there was a gentleman who was in the United States Congress named William Proxmire. And he would every year give out what he called the Golden Fleece Award. Now, clearly, maybe one award per year or a few awards a year was an acceptable number back then. Today, I think you'd need dozens or hundreds or even thousands of Golden Fleece Awards, because consider what they've been spending their money on. Would you believe queer farmers are worth your taxpayer dollars? Let me get to the details of that in just a moment. First, glad to have you with me. Glad to take your calls, too. If you want to join in on the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every single day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. If you happen to be a naysayer, we love naysayers on this show. You go right to the head of the line. If you disagree with my point of view or the point of view of some of our guests, we're glad to put you first. Just come prepared to make your best argument and stick around for a few questions afterward. But this one should unequivocally be one of those things that Americans would say, you want to spend your own money on that? You go right ahead. But how about this? The U.S. Department of Agriculture. Now, if you think about that federal agency, you'd say, well, let's see, I know they have the Forest Service is inside the U.S. Department of Agriculture, but isn't most of what they do concerned with farming in America? And do we need a federal agency for that? We could debate that all day long. But it turns out that U.S. taxpayers have spent millions of dollars on the most bizarre research out there. Let me give you one example. It is research into whether or not LGBTQ and what the study itself calls queer farmers, that they say one taxpayer-funded research grant studied queer farmers' quality of life in Pennsylvania. Now, I cannot imagine a legitimate reason for doing that kind of thing. And the researchers who were doing the interviews on this case to gather data, they were charging $373 every time they made a Zoom call to interview people about that subject. Now, that one was relatively small. Another one called the Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education Project paid almost $15,000 for that grant. And the grant was relatively small, as has been pointed out. The study of queer farmers went to Pennsylvania State University for a project titled Sexuality and Sustainable Agriculture, Examining Queer Farmers' Quality of Life in Pennsylvania. And the grant proposal even pointed out something I don't think you'd have to point out, and that was the topic has been woefully understudied. The deeply entrenched assumption of heteronormity in farming has excluded queer farmers from full inclusion and benefits from agriculture, even within sustainable agriculture. Hold on a second. If you're a farmer, does anybody care what your personal life is? If you're a farmer, do they care if you're gay or straight or celibate or anything else? The graduate student who assisted with the project, Michaela Hoffelmeyer, presented the findings to the Rural Sociological Society annual meeting in Richmond, Virginia. Her research showed that some of the challenges faced by queer farmers, again, that's the name given to them in the study, represented that findings suggest that transgender, non-binary, and women farmers face additional hurdles, but creating support networks could overcome those challenges. Yeah, I would imagine that if you show up and you're a biological man, but you choose to take a woman's name, dress like a woman, and present yourself to other people as a woman, chances are the other farmers are going to think that you're a little bit odd, to say the least. Hoffelmeyer has gone on to, of course, join the faculty at the University of Wisconsin, where she's become a voice in the media and public policy on LGBTQ issues. It's interesting. Hoffelmeyer says on the university website that she applies feminist, queer, and labor theories in her research to inform agriculture and policy on how to make shifts to support viability, well-being, and sustainability. This is some of what your taxpayer dollars are funding. And then consider this, a second kind of study on what they call Latinx gender identities. They got an award for $15,000. This was during Joe Biden, and it was titled Farming as a Latinx, Analyzing How Ethnic and Gender Identities Shape Latino or Latina, that's men and women, participation in sustainable agriculture. The grant proposal points to a shift from white farmers in the U.S. to Hispanic farmers because of immigration, and takes a moment to consider Hispanic masculinity. And they literally ask this question: how do rural Latin American masculinities become reproduced or reshaped in the United States as they establish themselves as sustainable farmers? I don't know. I would think that if you're going to go out and do a hard physical job like farming, chances are you're going to be a bit on the masculine side. As I said, if the farmers see a transgender farmer show up, they might just question, you know, does this person understand what we're doing? We're here to grow food. We're not here as some kind of social experiment, but those are the kinds of things that your taxpayer dollars are funding. Let me go to Rhonda. Hey, Rhonda, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Well, Lars, I just kind of wanted to share with you the hassle that I'm having trying to get help with a HUD agency.
And Housing and Urban Development, that's HUD, right?
Yes, okay. Yes. I had, well, back in the day when we had the no-fault evictions, okay, it was horrible. So I had saved up some money, and I found a mobile home, and I was able to buy it for $6,000 free and clear.
Uh-huh.
And it had the Golden Oaks Senior Mobile Home Park. Well, unfortunately, because of some whistleblowing activity, which I'll share with you offline, I have lost my union pension.
Hold on. What does your union pension have to do with your mobile home? I'm not seeing the connection.
Well, this is what I'm trying to explain, is that because of some activity that I did in the past, my pension, it's gone. And I have been
what
left
was,
with just my
Rhonda, you're
security.
Leaving mysteries for my audience to figure out, and I don't like doing that to them. What was the activity you took part in that caused you to lose your union pension?
Oh, I blew the whistle against some theft and fraud at the Portland Public Schools.
Okay, but they took your pension because you were a whistleblower? I'm not sure do that.
Okay, that's a totally different story. What I'm trying to explain is that's why I ended up having to be on HUD. I have a Section 8 housing voucher.
So the taxpayers are paying most of your rent?
Yes, but that's the rental space. And that, I want that clear. It's just for the rental space.
Okay, I need you to get to the point, Rhonda, or we're going to run out of time.
The point is that the people that bought this park, IPG Group, have cut all of the amenities, and we have old growth trees. There's 117 mobile homes here right now.
Okay, Rhonda, I'm out of time, but it sounds like you've got a dispute with the park. And guess what happens when you tell landlords they can't evict people, they can't raise the rent, they can't recover their costs? They're going to cut a lot of the amenities, and I'm sorry for that. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. Now.
I know y'all think it takes balls to be singing what I'm singing, but I'm just saying what you're thinking.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and emails. Here's a question you should consider. A lot of changes are happening at the federal level. Should Medicaid money, just so you don't, in case you didn't realize this, Medicaid is health insurance paid for by taxpayers for the poor. Medicare is generally for the older, the elderly. But should Medicaid money go to low-income families for health care instead of going off to Planned Parenthood? Abby Johnson joins us now, a former Planned Parenthood director, but she saw the light, and founder of And Then There Were None and Pro-Life Ministries, Pro-Love Ministries, I should say. Abby, welcome back.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me on again.
This doesn't seem like a hard problem to solve, does it? Stop funding the biggest abortion provider in America, which is Planned Parenthood. They murder more babies than any other entity in the country, and give the money either to federally funded health clinics or through Medicaid.
Yeah.
This sounds like low-hanging fruit, doesn't it?
It is, and I have to tell you, there are several pockets of money that could be removed from Planned Parenthood. So the majority, the bulk of money that goes to Planned Parenthood comes from Title Cash Grant Funds or Title 19 Medicaid. So there's three pots of Title Cash Grant funding, Title 5, Title 10, and Title 20. When President Trump was in office in his first term, he did a wonderful thing by eliminating Planned Parenthood and other abortion providers from Title 10 funds, and he did it with just a stroke of his pen. He could very easily do that again, but not just from Title 10, but from Title 5 and Title 20. Super simple. They would lose millions and millions of dollars. I mean, he's talking about removing Planned Parenthood. He's talking about removing about $27 million because of DEI-funded programs. But let me tell you something. They're receiving over $700 million a year of our tax money. $27 million is chump change to them. We need to talk about removing hundreds of millions of dollars of money from them, not just $27 million.
Well, I agree. In fact, Abby, I was remiss because for years I've been using the $500 million, half a billion, and the number has grown, as you point out, $700 million. Is there any way just to defund Planned Parenthood altogether? And just say, you don't need the money. And my first argument to people, they say, well, women won't be able to get health care, poor women. And I say, well, we have 1,500 federally funded health care clinics that operate in 15,000 locations around America. Is that not enough? You know, and have them get their health care there. With 15,000 locations, they sound more ubiquitous than Starbucks or Dutch Brothers. So why not just say, get your help over there? And if they need some extra dollars, we've now saved $700 million, almost $750 million. We shouldn't have to fund any more. Does that work?
Yeah, you're right. The problem is, though, every single program is going to have to be defunded separately.
Oh, God.
So that's what I was saying.
No, can you tell my audience, make it understandable for a lay audience and a lay person like me, why do we have to go through one at a time and click all these little boxes to defund them a piece at a time?
Because they're all completely separate programs that are supposed to be going for completely separate things. However, Planned Parenthood is using them for minors, to get health care without their parents' consent, for undocumented immigrants, for them to get health care, for them to get birth control, for them to push abortion. That's not what these title programs were initially used for, but that's what Planned Parenthood is using them for. So, but here's the thing, Lars. It's very easy for Trump to do. He did it in the first term. He can do it again with these three cash grant pots of money. The most difficult to defund and the largest funding that goes to Planned Parenthood is the Title 19 program, the traditional Medicaid program. But we know it can be done. Right now, that's what's going in front of the Supreme Court right now. And they're looking at South Dakota, and they're saying, okay, you know, we want to remove funds in South Dakota from any abortion-affiliating provider. So certainly that's Planned Parenthood and any other provider, because there's other abortion providers besides Planned Parenthood. And their argument is, if they're performing abortions, then they shouldn't be receiving government money, right?
That's okay. The Hyde Amendment
that's right.
Per se,
that
right?
is the Hyde Amendment. That's the Hyde Amendment. And so they're saying we want to enforce this. But now all these, you know, leftists are saying, oh, my gosh, just like you said, women are not going to be able to get health care. Well, here's the fact, okay? There are just five Planned Parenthood facilities in South Dakota. I want you to know, I want your listeners to know, though, that in South Dakota, there are 55 federally qualified health centers in South Dakota. And to break it down even more, there are 40 rural health care facilities. There are 58 critical access hospitals, and there are 39 rural health clinics. We're talking about a lot of health care available for people that live in South Dakota and need health care. We're talking about dozens and dozens of health care facilities for low-income men, women, and children, because FQHCs are far more comprehensive and provide far more comprehensive health care than five Planned Parenthood facilities. This is a no-brainer. We don't need Planned Parenthood in order to get health care. That is ridiculous.
But Abby, that's how they've always tried to sell it. Because I don't like Planned Parenthood. They're the biggest abortion provider. But they'll say, well, women won't be able to get their mammograms. And I said, yeah, they will. In fact, as I understand it, Planned Parenthood they'll provide you a referral to a mammogram provider, but they don't actually do mammograms. And I've looked at their own breakdown.
Not one.
What have they done? They'll say the smallest thing we do is abortions. Well, I guess depending on how you count them, the biggest thing they do is birth control. The second biggest thing they do is STIs, sexually transmitted infections. And the third biggest thing they do is abortions. And they don't do much of anything beyond that. Did I get anything on that wrong?
No, that's correct. And I'll tell you this, too, in your audience. If you look at the trajectory, if you look at the trend over the past 10 years, the only thing that has increased, the only services that have increased at Planned Parenthood are abortion services and our federal dollars. If you look at a 10-year time lapse of the services that Planned Parenthood has provided, contraceptive services are down by over 70%.
Wow.
Pap smears down by over 70%. Those breast exams they talk about, there's not a Planned Parenthood in the country that has a mammogram machine. There's never been a mammogram machine anywhere in a Planned Parenthood facility. You have to have a special license to operate a mammogram machine, and none of them have it. But, you know, just a manual breast exam that you could get from any doctor, any medical professional, those have gone down by over 70%. STD care has gone down by over 70% over the past 10 years. The only thing that it's increased significantly are abortion services and our tax dollars. So that's what we need to be looking at. Planned Parenthood is not here to provide some sort of amazing health care service in your community. They are only in your community because they are trying to kill your local citizens by abortion.
Unbelievable. Abby, thank you so much. Abby Johnson is a former Planned Parenthood director, founder, and Then There Were None Pro-Love Ministries. Abby, I appreciate the time. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis.
He may talk about serious issues, but even Lars has a sense of humor.
I have a joke for you. The government in this town is excellent and uses your tax dollars efficiently.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. This segment of the show brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medical specialists at Oregon Medical Centers. And our X poll today, should states end vote by mail? There is a bill before the Oregon legislature. I would estimate its chance of success at about zero, but it's been introduced by a Republican, Senator David Brock Smith, who says we ought to put the vote by mail system to a vote and then decide whether or not to keep it. I've always thought that vote by mail was a disaster and we should do away with it and go back to poll voting. I would even argue it might end up being both faster, more accurate, and cheaper than the current vote by mail system. But Senate Bill 210 is a bill that would end mail-in voting, require voter ID, and ensure in-person voting on Election Day in the state of Oregon. It would retain mail-in voting for military and overseas, as well as those with a mailing address outside the state. Mail-in voting was first approved in 1981, adopted by a majority of counties by 1987, and then in 98, voters approved a measure that all elections be vote by mail, and the cheating went on. So, today's X poll can be found at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Let's go to Kirk. Hey, Kirk, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Oh, hi, Lars. I just want to talk to you about the Finnish icebreakers.
Yeah, because right now we have an American company that's actually in America but owned by a Singapore company that got the contract to build icebreakers 6 years ago, and they've produced nothing. And they claim they will actually deliver the icebreakers that was supposed to be delivered last year sometime in 2030, and the price has not quite tripled, but it is more than doubled. And so President Trump says, we're going to buy the icebreakers from Finland. And given their neighborhood, wouldn't you guess the Finnish have some idea how to build an icebreaker?
Well, yes, I do. But I served on both the Polar Sea and Polar Star. And the problem with the Finnish icebreakers, they just don't, they're not strong enough. So now if they're going to build us one like we have, then that would be fine. But if they're using their design and their power structure, not going to happen.
Well, let me ask you this, just so we understand we're doing apples to apples. How old, when was the ship you served on, when was that built?
It was 75 and 76, I think.
Okay, so it was built 50 years ago. Would you imagine that even the ones that VT, that what's it called, VT Heartland, the company in Pascagoula, that had promised to build the first icebreaker to be delivered last year and hasn't delivered a damn thing at this point. It's called VT Harder or Halter Marine. Those designs have changed a bit in the last 50 years.
Oh yeah, they have. But again,
the Finnish finished. I love saying that. The Finnish finished their latest icebreaker about 9 years ago. I would imagine the newer ones are different than the original ones, and they live in the neighborhood. Are you telling me that their icebreakers today are not adequate for what we need?
Not the style of way they do it. I looked up the icebreakers you talked about. They don't even have the range to get to Antarctica, and that's where the polar icebreakers work.
Well, I'm guessing that if Trump says we're going to buy from them, then he's going to have to address that issue, isn't he?
Yeah, and they're going to have to be bigger and heavier because that's the way the United States likes to break ice, by heavy icebreakers, by jamming that, running down onto the ice.
Right, because they're a big, thick hull, but they don't just push through it. They kind of run up onto it, and then the ship's weight basically pushes the ice and breaks it underneath it, and they have to have substantial power plants. But I can't believe that we have a federal government that said we need three new icebreakers. They hire a company that has a track record for going over budget and for long delays, and they set the contract 6 years ago, and the company hasn't delivered a single icebreaker yet. Is there any good reason to continue a contract like that?
Oh no, I agree with you on that. That's ridiculous. And they could have, for a fraction of the cost, refit the Polar Sea and had her up and running by now. But
is there any other reason they're not sticking with the older ship and just say, let's put a bigger power plant in it?
They should have done that, but I don't know. You know, I think it was politics.
Yeah, I'm sure that somebody in Mississippi is benefiting big time because they originally promised that ship, the ship that was supposed to be delivered last year, that won't be delivered until 2030, was $745 million. And now they're saying, oh, sorry, boss, I know we were supposed to deliver, but it's now gone to $1.7 billion and we haven't even started building it yet.
Well, yeah, I'm right there with you. I mean, they were talking about building icebreakers before I retired. But the politicians get involved, and they keep trying to get it to Louisiana or anything like that.
Do you remember what happened when Trump called Boeing up and said, nah, $4 billion for Air Force One, that's too much? You remember what they did?
Oh, yeah, they built it cheaper.
Yeah.
And that's what he's going to have to do.
And doesn't that always happen? I mean, every once in a while you run into somebody who sort of overbids a project, and you say, nah, too expensive, I can't afford it. And then all of a sudden the contractor comes back to you and says, hey, tell you what, we can do that for a whole lot less than we promised you originally. We'll get it done. Kirk, thanks for the call. Back in a moment, you're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson.